The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Caleb Benjamin, intern at Lawfare, with an episode of Rational Security for November 5th, 2023. For today's episode, the team at Lawfare decided to cross-post this week's episode of Rational Security, a podcast hosted by Scott R. Anderson, Quinta Jurassic, and Alan Rosenstein, in which they cover the week's big national security news stories. Today's episode is entitled The Regulatory Cage Match Edition. In the episode, Anderson, Jurassic, and Rosenstein sat down with Eugenia Lostri to discuss the Biden administration's executive order on AI, easing of sanctions on Venezuela in exchange for the release of political prisoners and a promise to hold competitive elections, the start of new Speaker of the House Mike Johnson's tenure, and more. This is Rational Security.
So, Alan, we had a fairly wintry Halloween here in Washington, D.C. How was it in Minnesota, and what did you and your son go as in your family? Do you have a family theme costume this year?
So we had a very wintry Halloween as well. It snowed quite a bit the night before.
Oh, wow.
It snowed.
Yes. Welcome to Minnesota. And our family went as lions. My son has an incredibly cute lion outfit, and my wife made sure to get her and me matching lion headdresses, head stuff.
Love it.
So we went as lions. My son was very impressed with his tail. He kept running around going, "Lion tail, so good." It was really good.
Your hair is not unlion-like. I feel like you just needed to like kind of pick it out a little bit and you could really get it going.
It is a bit of a mane.
My son was a lion last year because we had not yet cut his hair. And so his hair was like 8 or 9 inches long and was just everywhere. And we just kind of puffed it out and made it the mane.
Well, your family also has the hair color for that. I mean, I don't know how many brunette lions there are. It's a Jewish lion, so you understand. Somewhere.
It's a Jewish lion, exactly. They're there. My son wanted to be a jungle bird this year.
A jungle bird?
A jungle bird, very
like
specifically.
A parrot?
That's how we chose to interpret it. At some point, he said hummingbird, and we're like, oh, buddy, we bought the parrot costume. And he's like, all right, that's fine. But it was very cute. He was impressed by the wings. He tried to fly, and he wanted us to be jungle
birds.
How did
that go? Did he jump off the roof?
He just kept sprinting down the road, like, flapping his arms. I think he would take off, but he never did. And then he wanted us to be jungle birds as well. So I tried to get my wife to go as a bottle of Campari, and I was going to go as a bottle of rum, and then we were going to be the jungle bird cocktail. But she vetoed that. It's not family friendly. Probably correctly.
It might be pushing it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, we have a reputation on the block we got to maintain. So, hello, everyone, and welcome back to a very spooky Rational Security. That's not the spooky vampire. That's the counting vampire.
Yeah, that was the count.
I was the count. Well, it's nearly the only vampire right now. The voice I do regularly for my kid. But we're excited to have everyone here, including my co-host, Quinta Jurassic.
Hello.
And my other co-host, Alan Rosenstein.
Hello, hello.
And I am, of course, one of your other, the third of the regular co-hosts, Scott R. Anderson. And we are thrilled to be joined with her for her Rational Security debut, Lawfare Cyber Fellow Eugenia Lostri. Eugenia, thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
We're very excited. I did not realize we had not had you on Rational Security yet, which I'm a little embarrassed by. I actually thought I had a distinct memory of having you on, and I don't know where that came from, but I entirely fabricated it. I do sometimes have dream episodes of Rational Security.
Are you serious?
Early in our run, I was very nervous about coming up with punny titles and topic segments, and so the night before, I'd be doing it as I go to bed.
Oh,
I would occasionally have dreams, so maybe that's wormed its way into my psyche, but we're thrilled to have you on to talk about some things happening in the cyber and tech space.
Well, nothing cyber has been happening in the last year, so I think it makes sense that this is my first time.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a big year for cyber.
Yes.
We're really still a very analog society. That's the key takeaway from this experience. Well, this week we are going to dig into the tech space and the regulatory space for our topic. We are going to deal with a few topics that have been kind of hovering in the background that we're going to talk about, that we wanted to talk about for a while. Taking a small break for some of the big stories in the Middle East and elsewhere that we've been talking about the last few weeks and that we'll no doubt be talking about next week. But this week we wanted to zoom in on a couple of other topics to discuss and what we're going to call the regulatory cage match edition in honor of at least one of our topics. Really, all three have a little bit of a regulatory angle on them. Topic one, broken AI. The Biden administration has rolled out a groundbreaking new executive order on artificial intelligence that seeks to take the first steps towards a real regulatory regime for this revolutionary technology. Is this a responsible step, or does it threaten to put the U.S. development of AI in a regulatory cage? Topic two, ending the fracas in Caracas. The Biden administration is taking a step towards thawing relations with the Maduro regime in Venezuela, easing sanctions at least temporarily in exchange for the release of political prisoners and a promise to hold competitive elections, though Maduro has yet to agree to ensure that most prominent opposition figures will be allowed to participate. Is this the right path forward or folly? And topic three, let's get Mikey to do it. He'll try anything. We have a new Speaker of the House in the form of Representative Mike Johnson, and he has decided to open his speakership with a bold move, separating aid from Israel out from other emergency measures and insisting that it be funded by cuts from the Internal Revenue Service, a model popular with the more conservative elements of the Republican caucus in the House, but that President Biden has promised to veto and that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has come out publicly against. What does this tell us about the direction Congress is headed in the weeks to come? For our first topic, I'm going to hand it over to me to introduce, because I did not get out of having to transition to myself this week.
I got to say, this happens every couple of months where you are the first person to do the topic, and I just love it because there's always, and I'm going to transition it to me. There's like this like Mario Brothers inflection whenever you do it.
Mario.
It's a childhood delay.
Exactly. That's the only way I can refer to myself is as a video game character, which is appropriate for this particular segment. We are, of course, talking about the very lengthy, very complicated executive order that the Biden administration put out earlier this week after having kind of previewed it a few days earlier, kind of confusingly, and talked as if they had put it out. And then we all tried to find the text and realized it still wasn't out yet. But they did eventually get it out there. It's interesting use of the Defense Production Act, a authority that I think a lot of people are probably familiar with from the recent battle with COVID, where it was deployed to help increase the manufacture of various, I think, vaccines, if I recall correctly, also masks and certain other safety and hygiene equipment. Somewhat controversially, it faced some legal challenges in certain regards in that domain. And now we're seeing it put to use alongside a number of other illegal authorities in the AI space. This isn't the first time the Biden administration has stepped into this space. We saw kind of a statement of principles maybe about a year ago, I want to say, maybe a little bit more. That was kind of an executive branch guidance document that seemed to lay out a roadmap saying, here are a couple of key interests regarding AI. Here's a way that we're thinking about regulating it. Here's some kind of preliminary guidance for states, for private actors, for federal agencies. But this really goes much further in trying to build out an actual legal infrastructure, a lot of which at this point is still preliminary or kind of kicking off studies and evaluations to see what the further steps will be. But that nonetheless can be an important political first step, but including a few actual regulatory measures that will actually shape how AI is used, developed, and interacted with by actors subject to those. So, Eugenia, let me hand it over to you as somebody I know who thinks a lot about AI and other issues in this space. Tell us a little bit about what jumps out to you as the key elements of this executive order and where it fits into the Biden administration's kind of broader strategy. How should we be thinking about the most important parameters of this executive order?
So I think we can definitely see the AIEO as the U.S. officially throwing the hat in the ring. Is that the appropriate expression? I'm always confused by American expressions.
Yeah. We don't wear hats and we rarely have sports with rings these days.
I have no idea where that comes from.
Okay. I've always wanted to use this. So here's
my
opportunity.
This is your moment.
So the U.S. is throwing the hat in the ring of AI regulation discussions, right? You mentioned that they've issued statements before. There are some principles. They've been participating in the discussions. But when you compare it to some of the other jurisdictions that have been thinking about it, this is the first time that we have kind of sweeping action. And, as they are themselves trying to present it, this is a really distinct approach that they're trying to try. You know, I think it's also interesting to note here that this is happening in the same week that the UK is hosting its AI summit, and you have the G7 issuing the statement on the AI Hiroshima, no, the Hiroshima AI process. So there's definitely a lot happening this week, and this is just one of those elements. And the US is definitely trying to put forth and convince other countries that their position is the way forward. So what does the EO actually do? Right. I think it's interesting that it starts in a way that is somewhat cliched, because this is the way in which I see so many white papers, so many reports start out, which is, oh, insert technology here, holds extraordinary potential, but also extraordinary risk. In this case, of course, AI. And it basically directs agencies to balance this promise, the risks, but also to ensure that the U.S. continues to be a leader in the space. And I think that is a sentiment that, you know, you can find throughout the EO. They set out 8 principles that should govern the development of and use of AI. I'm just going to read them just to give you a sense of how broad the scope of the executive order is, right? So you have first, artificial intelligence must be safe and secure. Second, promoting responsible innovation, competition, and collaboration will allow the U.S. to lead in AI and unlock the technology's potential to solve some of society's most difficult challenges. 3. The responsible development and use of AI require a commitment to supporting American workers. 4. Artificial intelligence policies must be consistent with the administration's dedication to advancing equity and civil rights. The interests of Americans who increasingly use, interact with, or purchase AI and AI-enabled products in their daily lives must be protected. 6. Americans' privacy and civil liberties must be protected as AI continues advancing. 7. It is important to manage the risks from the federal government's own use of AI and increase its internal capacity to regulate, govern, and support responsible use of AI to deliver better results for Americans. And 8. The federal government should lead the way to global societal, economic, and technological progress, as the United States has in previous eras of disruptive innovation and change. So, of course, not all these sections as you go through the EO are equally developed or are equally detailed. There's some very good analysis in an article on The Atlantic from Karen Ho and Mateo Wong that I think captured some of my own feelings after reading this, which was basically, if the document reads like a smashing together of papers written by completely different groups, that's because it likely is. And I think that definitely stuck out for me. Yes. But, you know, I think I want to be positive about the executive order. This is very ambitious. It is good that the administration is doing work. A way of thinking about it that I particularly liked, and I heard this in the AI Breakdown podcast, is that this is the administration kind of planting a flag on what are the issues that need to be studied, that needs to be addressed. And that is precisely why, as you mentioned before, a lot of the outcomes that we're going to see are likely studies being conducted, reports being written, guidance being issued, and not necessarily coming out right now saying this is the very regulatory approach that we're taking. I also want to flag, you know, we can find this a little bit underwhelming maybe, especially when they're saying this is some of the most ambitious work on AI that is happening anywhere in the world. But kind of the catalyst for a lot of the attention on AI, which is the release of ChatGPT, happened less than a year ago or almost a year ago. So, you know, it's kind of impressive to have a document that is this long, detailed, it covers so much, and you know, for the speed of bureaucracy, you know, this is quite good. I think we can see that as a win. And then lastly, I would say that not the EO, but in the fact sheet, you can see it directly. There is a recognition of the limits of how much the administration can do by itself. And so it does call on Congress to say, you're supposed to be working on privacy legislation. And this is definitely, AI in general is going to be an area where Congress will need to step up.
So you mentioned that this reads like the bringing together or jamming together a bunch of different interests. What leads you to that? Can you give us a few examples? Like, what are the different stakeholders that you see reflected in here that don't seem to be necessarily meeting in the middle in the most cohesive way that makes this seem a little patchwork?
So I think for the different sections, you definitely have input from different stakeholders. And so in some cases, you're going to have some of the language that replicates what some of the big tech companies are putting out, or the way that they're thinking about, you know, what is reasonable in terms of regulation for themselves. But then when you go to the section about protecting workers, where you talk about, you know, safety and trust, when you talk about watermarking, when you're talking about the detection of synthetic content, for example, I think you can see the influence of maybe more civil society-minded stakeholders. And, you know, I think in particular the fact that they're calling out specific measures like watermarking for, you know, how to do it, it shows that in some of these issues, there's been more thinking, or these considerations have been in their minds for a little bit longer.
Interesting. Yeah, Alan, you have talked to us about this before and about the need to strike the right balance between kind of AI development and regulation, about concern over AI and the potential for AI. Do you have a sense or a feeling about where this falls on the spectrum, acknowledging that a lot of this is still pretty preliminary? Like, do you have a gut reaction to where this falls, or is it kind of a wait and see?
I mean, kind of both. I mean, it's fine, right? This is the thing about AI. No one's actually really even sure what it is or where it's going, how it works. So, you know, expecting the government, which is already several levels removed from the actual technology, to be able to comprehensively regulate it when, frankly, Sam Altman barely understands, you know, what's going on in his own systems. And I don't say that as a criticism of Sam Altman. It's just the nature of the technology. It's a little unrealistic. And I think they've done this in a reasonably light touch way. I mean, you know, I think there's been a lot of hyperventilating among Silicon Valley types that, you know, this is showing that the U.S. is going to hamstring AI through this, you know, regulatory bloat. And I just don't see what in this is even, frankly, doing anything, let alone doing something to the extent of seriously interfering with the development of AI. I mean, yes, there's some reporting requirements from the Defense Production Act. There's, you know, a reaffirmation of the FTC's ability to go after, you know, false and misleading information in consumer products. But of course, the FTC has always had that. We didn't need an executive order to reiterate that. Lina Khan's been saying that for, you know, over a year now. There's calls for the federal government to staff up on AI expertise. But of course, that'll take years and years because there aren't that many AI experts. And why would you go to the government when you can be paid millions of dollars, literally millions of dollars, to go work for Google or Microsoft or OpenAI on this? And then there's a bunch of recommendations, which is like, fine, the administration can recommend anything it wants. So if anything, this is erring very much on the light touch side. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but it's about as far from overreach as we can get. I mean, to me, the most interesting thing here is the Defense Production Act part, because I think, A, there's a substantive interesting question about what does the Defense Production Act do? It's this law we never think about until we ever so often occasionally think about it. And, you know, it'd be worth doing a deep dive into this at some point. I'm just kind of curious what this thing actually allows the federal government to do. But the other reason I think it's interesting is because it's kind of showing that there aren't that many existing regulatory tools that the administration has. I mean, there is the FTC, but again, the FTC's ambit is somewhat limited. There's no AI regulation. Obviously, Congress isn't going to do anything. I mean, let's be real. So, you know, are we going to be stuck with the administration trying to use the Defense Production Act to regulate AI? I mean, are they going to declare a national emergency so they can use various emergency authorities? I think it just shows the kind of paucity of regulatory frameworks that are available. And, you know, I, for one, am very interested about the creative lawyering that will no doubt go into squeezing every drop of regulatory juice out of the Defense Production Act.
Yeah, that's really what jumped out to me too. I think before we recorded, while you were not here because you live in Minnesota, I said Alan and I will be interested in this very technical, stupid legal angle of this that has very little to do with the actual substance.
Yeah, Scott, you and I should do our deep dive into the Defense Production Act that the two of us will read and no one else.
Exactly, because it is really like there's two legal authorities this leans on, really, in what it actually does operationalizes. You know, whenever this gets implemented, so today or whenever the actual implementation date is. One is the DPA, the Defense Production Act, and the other is the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, IEPA. The IEPA use seems relatively straightforward, in part because IEPA is incredibly broad and interpreted incredibly broadly, as long as there's a foreign nexus, and that's what it's using it for here. The problem is you can't do that for primarily domestic purposes, essentially. And so it doesn't really help you with domestic regulation. That's why the use of the DPA is so interesting, because they essentially are using the DPA here to establish a regulatory regime and a transparency regime. The biggest DPA kind of ask here is requiring reporting obligations from a bunch of basically the big actors in the AI industry. And I'm trying to think if that's a way that DPA has been used before. I don't know. I know AIPA extremely well, and DPA I know less well, but it's not a natural use from the DPA, which is designed to and was originally intended to allow the president to force industry to develop materiel that you need to address a national emergency, like weapons traditionally, most recently, like, again, vaccines, masks, things like that in the context of the global pandemic. It can apply to any sort of national emergency. There is a national emergency declared in relation to AI issues. And so you can invoke that here. I think it's the same one, underlying one for the AIPA usage as well. But I can't imagine that doesn't come under challenge of some sort. And like, you have a lot of major actors in the AI space saying, yeah, we want responsible regulation. Query whether that's in good faith or a little bit of a cynical move to, you know, try and hedge people out from the industry and consolidate, control the industry and the existing big actors, or other nefarious purposes. Let's be honest, it's probably a little bit of both. But the reality is, like, maybe they have an incentive not to challenge this, but there very well might be other AI actors. And it wouldn't be hard, especially given how lax we've seen the Fifth Circuit be on standing about challenging federal regulatory measures the last year or two in the post-Trump Fifth Circuit era. Like, I'd be surprised if these aren't legally challenged, honestly, at some point, because it is a regulatory burden. And the Supreme Court, like, doesn't like the agencies using broad statutory authorities designed for very different purposes decades ago to address major societal questions.
You know who's going to step in is Clearview AI. They're here. They're tanned. They're rested. They're ready.
You may be right, honestly.
But no, I think, Scott, you're totally right. I mean, the major questions doctrine challenge, the First Amendment challenge, the straight up non-delegation doctrine challenge, they write themselves in cases like this. And so I would not be surprised at all if we get litigation in the next year or two in which, you know, this stuff is struck down in a way that also has some pretty consequential effects on other parts of the law.
I actually, you know, I was joking about Clearview, but the more I think about it over the last 30 seconds since I made that joke, the more convinced I am. Because they've already been making these arguments that they have a First Amendment protection right. against certain privacy regulations that would prevent them from using data on people's faces. So I think Floyd Abrams is going to be the white knight here for Sam Altman. He's going to swoop in on behalf of Clearview AI, and they're going to do this. Mark my words, listeners.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be very interesting. And then the question becomes, like, how much are these regulatory measures in effort to carve out a space in a regulatory role that you're then, after they get struck down, expecting Congress to step in for? Because it's a lot easier for Congress to say, well, we had this regulatory regime for like a year and a half or 2 years before finally the Supreme Court stepped in and struck it down. And we don't really – yeah, we may not be perfect, but we can all agree it's better than nothing, and we have a starting point. And so maybe we can agree to just reenact it. I mean, that's actually what has happened historically around, like, various types of trade restrictions and the Export Control Act, right, like, was a statutory authority that lapsed over and over again. The president used AIPA to keep it alive. When it lapsed, Congress would eventually say, like, oh, I guess we do need an Export Control Act to reenact it. And then finally, like, 5 years ago, finally actually installed a permanent Export Control Act. So
that's actually something that I've seen a lot of commentary on, how this marks a roadmap for Congress to say these are the areas where you should be, you know, that the areas that you should be paying attention to.
Yeah, exactly. And that it's a little bit of a different dialogue than a straight regulatory action.
I mean, I also wonder, and I genuinely don't know the answer to this question. Alan Nahani, I'm curious for your thoughts, whether it might be politically easier for Congress to actually take some steps here insofar as, A, you could frame this as we need to, you know, shore up U.S. industry to protect against big bad China. Which can get bipartisan agreement, and B, even though this is kind of at odds with point A, everyone hates the tech companies. And whereas on Section 230, everyone hates the tech companies, but they want diametrically opposed things, so nothing has been done. In this instance, the sort of problems are inchoate enough and haven't yet developed sort of standard partisan lines in such a way that I wonder whether it might actually be possible to sort of cobble together an agreement on what regulation could look like, especially if the administration has already kind of set something out on the table. Maybe that's completely ridiculous. I don't know, but I do wonder.
Yeah. Do you guys have a sense about what the congressional engagement has been on this? I mean, my sense is that like Congress has actually been kind of responsible around this issue. We've seen some like fairly serious substantive hearings. They haven't turned into big partisan shouting fests. They've been a little industry friendly, I think, by some criticisms. But then again, like that's maybe not surprising from the outset in terms of you're dealing with a new emerging industry that you're trying to regulate. So like those are big voices you're going to hear from. You need to hear from other voices too, but at least like you do need to hear from them. So it does seem like a space where we might actually see congressional action a little more realistically than other spaces, or is the struggle over privacy and assorted other items that have been pretty – the source of a lot of bipartisan consensus on the need for something but have not really seen any progress towards any sort of legislative fix a sign that that's really not forthcoming? Mm-hmm. Eugenia, what do you think about that?
Oh, I was about to let Alan answer that first.
Alan, what do you think about that?
I don't think anything's going to happen. I mean – it's not.
I was trying to, throw something out be optimistic.
No, I'm pulling the full Quinta. I'm going full grump on this. Nothing's going to happen. Nothing ever happens. There's no privacy. We've been talking about privacy legislation for ever, right? And Congress has done exactly zero, right? There's no way they can do anything on AI. And it's great that they've been interested and engaged and all those sorts of things. But part of the reason is because no one's actually proposed anything meaningful. The moment you propose something meaningful, right, it's all gonna crash and burn anyway. Because at the end of the day, no matter what Sam Altman says about yes, we should be licensed, they don't want to be regulated, right? Certainly not regulated in a way that'll actually limit their ability to collect data, process that data, build models. Again, I'm not saying this is bad. Right. Maybe we should just go full speed ahead, as Mark Andreessen would like us to do, into our techno utopia. Skynet, Skynet be damned. If you zoom out long enough, technology really is generally a force for good. So maybe we should just do that. But
you can't see my expression, listeners.
Yeah, I'm half trolling Quinta. I can't resist.
There's Honey and I were both traumatized by Mark Andreessen's manifesto or whatever.
It's not a good manifesto.
The futurist manifesto,
He makes us techno. He makes it hard for us fellow techno utopians.
God, but Alan, I do have a question for you on that. Do you think that that sort of explains why in the EO you have maybe more focus on some of those long term hypothetical risks, and then when it comes to what we consider current risks about the deployment of AI for education, for example, you have, honestly, vaguer kind of promises or vaguer principles being applied to, this is important. But it's not as much as when you look at the impact of AI on like nuclear threats or biological threats.
I guess so, but I'm still just not convinced that scoping the problem narrowly is the key to getting Congress to engage. I mean, there are a million things Congress could do right now about privacy. Congress could outlaw Clearview AI tomorrow, right? On a unanimous vote or something like that, right? And yet they're not going to do it because it's just everything is hard. So, it's true that maybe dealing with AI in education is somehow easier or less complicated than dealing with existential Skynet AI. But even just dealing with AI in education is really complicated, right? Should we use AI?
I'm making the opposite argument. I'm saying it is easier to say that you're going to do work on those long-term hypothetical risks than it is to say, we're actually going to tackle this very real current concern.
Yeah, no, but that's depressing, right?
Oh, yeah,
okay, got it. Just make sure we're all on the same bummed out page.
Yeah.
Speaking of being bummed out, we now go several hours south to Venezuela.
But we're less bummed out in Venezuela now.
I think we're still pretty bummed out, man. I don't know. So, well, here's my intro. Listener, you can decide how bummed out you are or are not after I launch into my spiel. So Venezuela is currently headed for elections that could potentially challenge the hold on power of authoritarian President Nicolas Maduro. There have been recently some potentially hopeful signs that this could actually be a competitive election that could really call into question Maduro's grip on power. there was a sort of consolidated semi-official opposition primary where Maria Corina Machado, who is a former opposition legislator, won a pretty resounding victory. All of this is a happy story so far, and it goes along with a commitment by the United States recently to lift sanctions on Venezuelan oil in exchange for the Maduro government's commitment to fair elections. This is where the story stops being so happy. Sorry, Alan. Maduro's government recently barred Machado from running for office, despite that commitment that was made with this sort of opposition bloc and with the United States. This, I think, raises a number of questions, not only about whether Venezuela, but also how the U.S. is going to handle this, given that agreement to lift these sanctions. So, Scott, I definitely want to talk about the U.S. policy aspect with you. But, Eugenia, you've been following this. First off, I'm curious what you make of all of this. I guess to back up a little bit, first off, on what it says that Maduro was willing to make this agreement potentially to free and fair elections to begin with, and then what it means that he appears to have reneged, if he has indeed reneged, which I admit I am still somewhat confused about.
So I don't know if he has reneged. I think it must be, again, I'm going to caveat this by saying this is all my personal opinion, just my feelings and thoughts. But, you know, what does it mean that he agreed to this? Well, that the situation in Venezuela is not great, that the sanctions have been working and they continue to, you know, impact the economy and the people. You see a migratory crisis. There's, you know, not a lot of access to cover basic needs, and that is hurting the government. Now, Maduro, of course, does not want to lose power. I think Machado's results, she got 92% of the vote out of 10 opposition candidates,
which is like quite impressive.
It was quite impressive.
Is she popular, can I ask, or is this more kind of a reflection of Venezuelans wanting to consolidate around a sort of opposition figure so that she comes through very strongly?
I think she's a decently popular candidate, but I don't have a lot of authority to say that. But also the fact that a lot of people came out to vote. This election on Saturday was not organized by the official electoral commission. They, you know, asked them not to be involved because there are concerns about how they would interfere. There were concerns about fraud. So, you know, I think over 2 million people came out to vote, which from some of the analysis that I've read is pretty impressive for a primary. And I think it shows that if there were to be freer, fairer elections next year in Venezuela, the people are interested. They want to participate in the democratic process and they want to vote for an alternative. And I think that probably scared Maduro, who is now saying that the election, the primary election, was not conducted appropriately. There are accusations of fraud, and they're just challenging the legitimacy of Machado's candidacy.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate
data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
So when I first read about this story, and I should say I know very, very little about Venezuelan politics, it occurred to me that this seems like an extremely unusual instance of sanctions actually doing something. Because at least my read of the international relations literature or the consensus over the past 10, 15 years is that people have really soured on sanctions ever really being effective. And so I'm curious, Scott, if this is as unusual as I think it is, and if so, should we read anything into it regarding the effectiveness or lack thereof of sanctions to create good democratic results in the world?
Yeah, well, and this latest development is a sign that maybe these weren't as effective as we thought they were, or the effort to lift them. But, my view is that treating sanctions as kind of a category has always been a little bit of an error, because sanctions are very context specific in what they actually mean for a given state, right? This is a case where Venezuela is in a very unique geopolitical position. It is existing in a moment where there is growing major power competition. So you have an ability to pivot towards Russia or towards China that can substitute to some extent in for the United States, although frankly that is a lot harder in Latin America than it is in other parts of the world, which I think is a challenge that Venezuela is still wrestling with, which is part of the reason why it can't actually totally divorce itself from the United States as much as it might like to. And it is also at this moment where we've seen in the last year and a half, as the United States has been trying to advance a global campaign to put economic pressure on Russia, a big weak point of that is that they can't clamp down too much on energy production in Russia because that would have massive economic consequences in the rest of the world, and particularly in Europe, and might weaken European resolve to back Ukraine, among other factors, and just cause general, you know, human misery. So for that reason, something we've heard talked about for a while is like, well, maybe we can get Venezuela back up online, ease some sanctions, get their production up. And that is a long-term goal. I mean, the Venezuela's, by my understanding, Venezuela's petroleum sector, energy production sector, which is close ties with the United States in a lot of different regards. You know, one of its major subsidiaries is in the United States and is now under the control of Juan Guaido, the opposition figure that was recognized by the Trump administration as the interim president and who was given control of all these things as part of an effort to oust Maduro, essentially, or at least pressure Maduro into leaving. That failed pretty dramatically in this case. In this case where the sector has degraded enough that you can't really get production up without long-term investment. And you can only get long-term investment if you get major outside actors confident you're going to be in an environment that's at least sanctions predictable, if not sanctions free, because any investment they make there is going to have zero return value if all of a sudden they're not allowed to do business with Venezuela again later. And so it requires a much more calibrated balancing of interest to advance this. This bears on sanctions, right? Because from 2019 onward, the Trump administration embraced something really close to maximum pressure on Venezuela. The goal was we're going to basically do regime change in Venezuela by putting maximum economic pressure, using a shift in recognition of the Guaido government or regime to give them control of a lot of Venezuela's overseas financial assets, diplomatic holdings, things like that, in coordination with Europe. The United States didn't do this alone. It was a very coordinated international effort. And that all failed because it's really hard to get a regime out when you don't control facts on the ground. It's really hard to use external pressure to oust a regime, right? But what you might be able to do is horse trade a little bit. If you're willing to accept and say maximum pressure isn't the goal, it's not either maximum pressure or a complete collapse and a complete change that's contrary to the interest of the actual political actors. If you're saying, let's carve out, do some more horse trading, let's say we can set up specific incentives to incentivize certain behaviors, certain compromises, I think that can be more effective, and this is a sign that it's perhaps working here. The real question now is, well, what do we do that this opposition figure who I think to have a really meaningful opposition needs to be on the ballot? This is the real test, I would say. Like, let's see what the threat of the reimposition of these sanctions and other measures can actually do to try and pressure Maduro into taking the step. And even then, like, this is a step that really gets at the heart of his rule, right? Like, Maduro is personally in a really bad place if he gets ousted from the government. This is a real red line for him. It doesn't mean that you couldn't use sanctions to get concessions on lots of different spaces like we did with political prisoner releases, right? Again, it's context specific, but it's a more limited toolkit, and it's when you have to think of the strategic environment. And just saying, no, we're just going to maximum isolate a state until it completely fundamentally changes its means of governance in a way that is not in the interest of the people in charge with the guns and what resources are available on the ground, I don't think generally works. And I think it's a little bit of a foolhardy strategy, and I think this has helped demonstrate that.
I mean, the aspect of this that I'm kind of interested in is kind of at the same time that the Biden administration announced that they were lifting the sanctions and that the Barbados Agreement was going through, they also marked the end to a four-year suspension on returning Venezuelan migrants. So they renewed deportation flights back to Venezuela. And I'm kind of interested in hearing your thoughts on why now is, you know, Maduro suddenly seen as a trustworthy partner, that you're, you know, returning all these people home, because, you know, some of the reporting that I've read says, you know, once you leave, you're seen as a traitor, right, of the regime. So sending those people back, what are some of the, if you know, what are some of the protections in place? What are some of the commitments made by the Maduro administration to ensure that those people are safe?
Yeah, I mean, Scott, I'm curious for your thoughts here. I will say I was really struck by this as well, and I feel like it maybe speaks a little bit to how the Biden administration has been trying to position itself as quote unquote tough on immigration, which I have qualms with, but I think that you can see in this way how they're, you know, you might see a benefit in being able to say, look, we're sending people back. On the other hand, the politics of that are a bit complicated because when you drill down into who are the people you're sending and where are you sending them, a lot of the same sort of political allies who would normally be in favor of kicking, quote unquote, them all out would no longer be in favor, given that the Venezuelan immigrant community in the United States tends to be sort of anti-left and quite Republican. And there, I will say there's also an interesting twist here in the New York Times reporting on the matter that the indictment of Senator Menendez was actually very important to this going through, because Menendez, as the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he's Cuban-American, is very sort of anti-communist Latin American regime in the way that Cuban-Americans, many of them are, and so had been very opposed to deporting Venezuelan migrants. So sorry, Bob, now that he's no longer chair of SFRC, since he was indicted, he wasn't around to block that from happening.
I just want to say, Bob Menendez may not be the hero America wants, but he may well be the hero America deserves.
Or at least the hero that New Jersey deserves. Oh, yeah, so in all of those senses, I think that I could see how the Biden administration could see this as a potential win. But I do agree that the mechanics are somewhat complicated. And that's even before, as you say, Henny, we get to the question of, you know, what reassurances the Maduro regime may or may not have provided. Scott, I don't know if you have thoughts there.
No, I mean, that's the right set of questions, and also the process they went through, who these people are in terms of their relationship to the Maduro regime. You know, I would be a little surprised if people who are like people associated with the Guaido opposition movement were at serious risk of imprisonment for specific pre-existing reasons, as opposed to just generally perhaps having a stigma now for having left the country and come back. Those are, if I'm recalling, aspects of immigration law that I have not thought about in a while, but those can present very two very different fact patterns that one has a better chance of saying, okay, you have some basis for being able to claim asylum, another one less so. And I believe these are all people who have already gone through deportation proceedings. They would have already had whatever opportunities they're going to get to make those arguments. You can query how meaningful those are. They will have already got them. But I could be wrong about that. I actually don't know the details of that. But, you know, it is part of this big web that we find ourselves in that stems really from the 2019 choice, this decision to say, hey, we're going to try and levy and really make Venezuela a major foreign policy priority that weirdly really just lasted like a few months.
Remember when Venezuela was briefly about to be invaded by mercenaries?
I wrote a couple articles.
Bay of Pigs, baby.
It was just wild. Like, we had this moment, and it's such a strange moment to look back to. And there's a lot of things in that are emblematic of a lot of Trump administration foreign policy general, but foreign policy in particular, where clearly certain officials, probably John Bolton, probably – I'm blanking on the name of the gentleman who is his envoy for Venezuela right now, but it'll come back to me in a second. Elliot Abrams, I think, who was involved in this.
I think it was Elliot Abrams.
Yeah, I believe it was Elliot Abrams. If I have that wrong, I could be wrong. I apologize, but that's my recollection. You know, if you are – you had a moment where certain figures felt really strongly about this. They were able to get the president on board, get the administration built, again, a pretty impressive multilateral like effort to do this. Like, if you were going to try and do this, you couldn't have done it more effectively than they did in terms of getting most of the world on board with recognizing this opposition figure as opposed to Maduro. But then there was just very little follow through. Like, the follow through was all weird eclectic stuff, like maybe somebody in Guaido's government and maybe with a little help from the intelligence community, although I think that's very questionable whether that actually happened, trying to hire mercenaries to do some weird paramilitary stuff that doesn't really make sense in terms of anything that's going to change facts on the ground. Like, it's just not clear where this was going to go. And it's, again, this optimism that people have about what it takes to change regime and how fragile some of these more oppressive regimes are. And I think the clear answer we've learned here is that they're actually not that fragile. And often when you break them, it's not 100% clear what's going to follow in their wake. Like, that's what we learned in Afghanistan and Iraq, a lot of other places. Like, democracy is something that's hard to build, not that just falls naturally into place when you remove an authoritarian government, sadly. I mean, I wish it were that easy. And so, you know, I think the Biden administration has inherited this very complicated policy where they're still recognizing Guaido technically. I suspect that will change if we get an election, because he was always the interim president. But, you know, clearly they feel a need to engage with Maduro now, very realistically, I think, in line with their broader policy goals. And it's just a really hard needle to thread.
So going from one democratic/semi-democratic mess to another democratic/semi-democratic mess. Let's talk about our new speaker, Mike Johnson. After many weeks, the GOP finally got its act together and voted for, I think, basically Steve Scalise without the baggage or experience. I think that is the general consensus as to who Mike Johnson is. he's certainly not shying away from a political battle. So the first kind of big thing he stepped into, and that we'll be talking about in this segment, is this proposed aid package to Israel of $14 billion that Johnson, and therefore and presumably the House Republicans, would like to pay for by removing $14 billion from the IRS. Now, the way they're trying to spin this, of course, is that the aid to Israel is offset by a cut in government spending elsewhere. But of course, cuts to the IRS don't function like cuts to almost any other program, because the IRS is a really good investment in terms of how much you spend on it to how much you get out of it. So actually cutting $14 billion from the IRS doesn't actually save you $14 billion. It costs you probably many more billion dollars in terms of taxes not withheld. So it's pretty clear what game he's playing. It's cute. We'll see what happens. But you know, there's a lot to ask about sort of both this particular tactic and then sort of what this says about Johnson as a speaker. Let me start with you, Quinta. Do you think that this will succeed? Do you think he will actually be able to force spending cuts to the IRS, or is this just fun political theater? It'll get vetoed or it'll get ignored by the Senate, and then ultimately the House Republicans will swallow a offset free package of military aid to the Israelis because ultimately they really, really care about supporting Israel.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is pretty obviously not going anywhere. I'll eat my shoe if it goes anywhere. How's that?
This has been a bet people have been making all over the Lawfare office.
Exactly. I've been inspired.
And I don't know. A, I don't like it because my feet are way bigger than everyone else's here. And my shoes, therefore, it would be a lot more work. B, have you ever seen the Werner Herzog eats his shoe video?
No, but that sounds amazing.
So he actually did eat his shoe when his protege,
awesome.
Why am I blanking on his name, who did Fog of War and A Thin Blue Line, Elliot.
Errol Morris.
Errol Morris. Thank you. Gosh, I'm embarrassed. I blanked on that. Errol Morris, when Errol Morris, his first movie actually got picked up in theaters, Werner Herzog had to show up and eat his shoe, and he actually boiled a boot and ate it, I think, with steak sauce, like outside on a camp stove.
Oh, Werner.
And that's about the direction we're headed in here.
How do
it makes
you
me
eat
very
that?
Nervous.
I mean, like physically, it's a lot of chewing.
It's leather.
I mean, it's leather.
So it's
basically
meat. Just boil it.
Okay. We have an actual thing.
I'm a vegetarian, so I'm not doing this. So, I'm out.
So, no, I mean, I think that it seems pretty clear to me that this is not going anywhere, that this is sort of political posturing that is not particularly intended to go anywhere. There's a really excellent piece that we just published on Lawfare by Molly Reynolds called Speaker Johnson's First Test that sort of walks through the different moving pieces here. And the point that she makes is that this shows that, you know, while Johnson was sort of able to become speaker in the first place, and I'll just quote Molly here, the fundamental macro political dynamics that plagued former Speaker McCarthy remain. House Republicans have a slim majority and some of their members have threatened to oppose aid unless it's offset, which is referring to the IRS spending cuts. But at least two other GOP House members have announced that they will oppose any aid to Israel, leaving Johnson with little room for error within his own caucus. So what we're seeing here is both political posturing and a sort of very, very delicate dance that just shows how combustible the GOP House conference is right now. I think the situation is very different in the Senate. McConnell has not indicated that he's a huge fan of this, in part also because McConnell has been a big proponent of getting more aid to Ukraine. And part of, I think, the sort of political ploy with this bill is not only that it ties Israel aid to spending cuts, but that it also cleaves off aid to Ukraine, because that's been something that is quite controversial within the House Republican caucus, to try to, you know, maybe push that away, kick the can down the road a little bit, not have a big fight immediately right now. But it just seems to me like you're inevitably going to get some kind of a showdown between the House and the Senate over this. So as Molly points out, you know, Johnson is not someone with a huge amount of experience as far as speakers go. And so this is going to be a big test for him in terms of, you know, whatever his end goal is here, how well he's kind of able to navigate those political dynamics. And I don't think it is clear as of now.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. Here's the lessons I think I take away, or the key points or observations I would guess here. First, like, this is such an interesting salvo. A, it's clear this is a move towards the kind of Marjorie Taylor Greene wing of the party, who, by the way, she has already come out and said she wouldn't vote for this even because she just doesn't like want assistance to go overseas at all, essentially. But that kind of wing, the more isolationist wing, the wing that says, if we're going to allow this, we're going to demand cutoffs. Because he's saying, we're just going to do Israel. We're not going to talk about Ukraine. We're not going to talk about Taiwan, although Taiwan actually probably has more of those people in its camp than Ukraine does. And instead, we're just going to do this thing. And we're going to do it in a way that doesn't address traditional fiscal conservative values, which other people in his party do care about still. Some people, at least they feel like they have to maintain certain donors, to maintain certain reputations, to kind of fit with their ideological mold in their districts. Because this actually, again, as Alan correctly noted, hurts the budgetary picture further by reducing tax revenue. Instead, you're doing it and it cuts in a way that speaks even more to that radical kind of anti-Biden, tear it all down party, because the whole goal here is to undermine a major legislative accomplishment of the Biden administration, which through its infrastructure package it passed during the last Congress, got more funding for IRS. This is just trying to take it away. So the goal is just to tear down whatever the other team may have accomplished and try and get whatever pound of flesh you can get in that direction. Even though it's not clear what policy goal you're advancing here. Again, it hurts the budgetary picture, right? Like if you just – unless you just straight up just don't think people should pay taxes they're legally obligated to pay, it's not clear how this actually helps anything. But it's worth bearing in mind we have to see what he does with this here, right? Like maybe he's going to say, OK, I'm going to do the Boehner strategy where I let people vote on this stuff. I let them have their way and then it becomes clear it's not going anywhere. They get it out of their system. They can tell their constituents we voted for it. And then people will have to swallow a compromise. And yeah, those people will probably still vote against a compromise, but I can bring it to the floor. We'll get a handful of Democrats or maybe a lot of Democrats on board, depending on what it looks like. We'll get the more conventional Republicans in the fold. And the more radical side of my caucus will not be angry enough at me to threaten my leadership because Lord knows we just went through 3 weeks of complete chaos where we all look like idiots. And I did give them the opportunity to try and persuade people and they failed to do that, right? So like there's a strategy there and you get that. And the question then becomes like how much hardball does he get to that other side? The Senate can pass its own version. The House will then have it on the floor. He can bring it up for a vote saying, hey, we just have to look at the Senate version. You can go in a conference. You can try and find a way, some way to reconcile it, right, and come up with some new version. That gives you a lot of stuff you can do in black boxes and behind closed doors that can be make it a lot more politically feasible to swallow something, wrap it up a lot more sugar and obscurity to figure out where the compromises are. You're probably not going to get through that radical wing of the party, but the goal isn't necessarily to get them on board. It's just to get them satisfied enough that they don't threaten your leadership by undertaking this step. On the flip side here, he is in a tricky position because I kind of suspect Ukraine and particularly Israel and Taiwan and Ukraine and the border, actually all four of the issues that are in this, I think there's probably enough Republicans in the House that would seriously consider, particularly if they had big backing from Mitch McConnell or somebody else who has a lot of fundraising weight and a lot of kind of connections to make it them be able to do this without seriously undermining their political futures in the Republican Party, who might be willing to put a big fight over these items and say, no, we actually really need to do this. And if you get eight or nine of them, then you have people on both sides threatening to deep six's leadership. The difference is on one side, you have Democrats who will vote for the actual substantive legislation and get it through. On the other side, you don't, depending on, again, what it looks like. So I actually think there's a path here for those people to kind of win if Mike plays that route and doesn't give in to kind of the threats of the far Mike. Wing. Mike.
We're referring to him by his first name now.
Mike J. Mikey Mike. And, you know, really how radical they are. Like, are they willing to just tear it down? But I don't think that wing feels like they came out of this with a big win, right? Like, Mike Johnson's a pretty conservative guy, but they were under a lot of pressure and came under a lot of hostility. And the fact that you saw people kill the candidacy of much more conservative candidates for the speaker pretty heartily, to the point that on Jim Jordan's like second and third votes, you actually saw more people coming out publicly in opposition to him, should have been a warning shot. And I suspect will be received by a warning shot by Matt Gaetz and others saying, ooh, maybe we've played our hand a little far. We came out with Mike Johnson. That's a fine outcome for us. Maybe we have to give it a little time to cool off before we come back nuclear. So I kind of suspect that we will actually see some version of this go forward without these sort of crazy conditions on it. And a lot of it will happen because of closed-door negotiations and pressure brought within the Republican caucus we won't see. But I don't know. Everything's just so chaotic these days. You never know. And it all hinges on the decisions of just a few small actors because of the way the party split plays out in this case and the fact that nobody's willing to work across the alley to really do things effectively.
Yeah, I mean, we have a new speaker, but the House Republican Conference is still the same.
Yeah, it remains chaotic. Exactly.
Plus or minus George Santos, depending on whether or not they decide to expel him.
There you go. Well, folks, that brings us to the end of our time together this week. But this would not be Rational Security if we did not leave you with some object lessons to ponder over in the week to come. Alan, what do you have for us this week?
So one of the least important, but to my mind, most irritating things to come out of the Hamas attack on Israel is the wave of statements from universities, which are just, you know, lame. And it's just the whole thing has been just very unimpressive. And I just came across this extremely funny piece of satire by someone named Jeff Maurer, who, according to his bio, is a former writer for the John Oliver Show. So he's a political comedian. And it purports to be a corporate statement from Windex. And it begins as follows. Windex believes that the collective lands of Israel-Palestine belong to the Natufian people, who lived in the region during the late Epipaleolithic era, circa 10,000 BCE. The Israelis and Palestinians, as well as the Druze, Bedouins, and other peoples of the region, are interlopers with no legitimate claim to the land. And it just goes on and on. And it is one of the better pieces of satire I have read in quite some time. And having said all this, I just realized that this is my second week in a row in which my object lesson is a satire about institutional statements about the Israel-Hamas war. I'm really apparently obsessed with this issue. Sorry, guys. It just makes a really good satire.
It does. I agree. It is. I think it's a sign you may really be in a vibrant academic institution that just inhabits your brain so much. The very phenomena of these sorts of statements. Quinta, what do you have for us this week?
I would like to recommend some escapist media. I think maybe last year I recommended a silly pirate comedy on HBO called Our Flag Means Death and an Object Lesson, which was kind of like a workplace comedy, but the job is being a pirate. The second season just finished, and it is equally delightful. And this time it is workplace comedy of being a pirate and also a rom-com in the middle of that, and just is completely deranged. At one point, a character turns into a bird. Everyone just kind of moves on. I have no idea how it got made, and it is delightful. So if you are looking for something that is just kind of absurdist humor and a bit of escapism, I highly recommend it.
Wonderful. Well, for my object lesson this week, I am bringing you a story of the power of love, because 10 years ago yesterday was the 10-year anniversary of the day I met my wife, who I love very much.
Aww. Mazel tov.
And I am reflecting on, yeah, it's crazy to think it was a decade ago that we met, because it does not seem
like
that
long ago. You're an old man, Scott. It's okay.
Family and children and things like that these days. Yeah, I feel very old. It's wonderful. I never thought marriage would be as wonderful as it is. And 10 years in, I don't regret it for a second. So, monogamy, better than it's all cracked up for. Give it a shot.
Does your wife listen to the podcast?
She does listen to the podcast now. after having called her out pretty viciously in our third episode of the new version for not listening and therefore not recognizing Alan as my co-host at some point, she literally listens to every episode. So I'm looking forward to her hearing this when she realizes I deigned to talk about our meeting in a place called The Corniche, which is the over-romanticized name. It sounds very romantic. It is, in fact, the sidewalk of the embassy in Baghdad that people just call The Corniche, where we met. I'm looking forward to see how she reacts to this. She probably will not appreciate it. But she also will say after 10 years, this is kind of what I expected.
I will also say I also have known my wife for 10 years. So
yeah, this is a good year. Yeah,
you guys are both wife guys.
2013.
Wait, we're both what?
Year of love.
Wife guys.
We're definitely. I don't even know what wife guy means, definitely, but I have a feeling guys. I know, and we're definitely wife guys.
You're definitely a wife guy.
Yeah, solidly wife guy. I'm.
Is that like guys who really like being married?
I don't know.
Guys who let themselves go.
And I'm definitely a wife guy.
here's a article from the New York Times. The wife guy defines himself through a kind of overreaction to being married.
Yep, that sounds right.
That's awesome. To wife guys.
To wife guys. To wife guys everywhere. Yuhanya, what do you have for us today?
Okay, so that's hard to follow, though, because you guys are talking about how much you love your partners.
Really depressing. This is why I went after Quinta.
mine seems out. Really stupid now.
Yeah,
thanks.
It's not depressing. I'm more on the escapism, bucket here.
That's fair, too.
Yes, I'm going to recommend a video game. One of the things that I've been kind of sad about is that Baldur's Gate 3 came out recently, and my computer is not good enough. So I cannot play it. And so I've been looking for an alternative. And what I found is a 2015 game that Wikipedia calls the spiritual successor to the Baldur's Gate series. But because it's from 2015, I get to play it in my old computer. And it's fantastic. It's called Pillars of Eternity. And, if you are into role-playing, a game where your decisions actually impact what's happening, a lot of tough moral choices and very complex and mostly dark set of characters, I highly recommend you download Pillars of Eternity. Go play it.
I've heard wonderful things. I am not a video game person, but I grew up playing Baldur's Gate 1 and 2 and all the other Neverwinter. I'm a big Dungeons & Dragons nerd, as people know, or was at least in my childhood. And so I love all of these games. And so I bought Baldur's Gate 3, the first video game I bought in over a decade, because I bought Skyrim back before I got sent to Baghdad for a year and a half because I needed something to do. And I set it up. I got it to run on my computer in a pretty blocky, not perfect format. I had to buy a whole separate hard drive to fit it. And I have played exactly 90 minutes in the last month and have not had any time to do it.
I'm so jealous,
though. I'm not sure I ever will. But it is good. It's an impressive game.
I
have some other good friends who are quite into it. Well, excellent. That's an excellent recommendation. I will also say the old Baldur's Gate game is pretty sweet. Planescape Torment, really awesome. If you want to play an old, like 10 or 15-year-old, like RPG, back in the day, it was pretty awesome. That's all I remember. And I was always impressed by that. It's like the coolest of all those and most interesting of all those ones. It's kind of about like the afterlife. It's like a fantasy version of Dante's Inferno.
Ooh.
And so you're like traveling through the afterlife and planes, and there's all these like weird creatures, and it's great. So recommend folks check that out as well. I'll throw that in the hopper. That's a recommendation from like 13-year-old Scott, by the way, because I haven't looked at the same place. the kid had good taste. What can you say? Well, folks, that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Rational Security is, of course, a production of Lawfare. So please visit us at lawfaremedia.org for our show page, for links to past episodes, for our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other phenomenal podcast series. Also, be sure to follow us on X at RATL Security, and be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. Also, be sure to sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special benefits. For more details, visit lawfaremedia.org/support. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan. And we are once again edited by the wonderful Jen Patcha Howell. On behalf of my co-hosts, Alan and Quinta, and our special guest, Eugenia Lostri, I am Scott R. Anderson. We'll talk to you next week. Till then, goodbye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.